Dr. Garang Dutt is a 2017 Roth Segal John Monash Harvard Scholar who resettled in Australia under the Humanitarian Program for Refugees in 2005. He is a fellow in health systems at the Australian National University and an advisor, action researcher at the Australian Department of Health. His education at the University of Melbourne, Harvard University, and the University of Oxford has not distanced him from the shared experiences of other members within Melbourne's South Sudanese migrant community. His recent article, published by the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Public Health, draws on past experiences from living in a refugee camp with a view to informing health and economic policies. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Garang Dutt to the podcast. Garang, a very warm welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Justin.
So let's go back to where you first came to Australia. You arrived as a refugee from South Sudan. Can you tell us a bit about that journey to Australia?
Thank you, Justin, for this discussion. As you mentioned, I arrived in Australia with a refugee background. I had lived for over a decade in a Kenyan refugee camp, having just moved across the border from South Sudan, where there was war for a long time, and I was born into that war. So I grew up very much in a setting which was either a war zone, displaced camp, which means internally settled population within the borders of their birth, and then crossing the international border, which then made me a refugee. And that's where I grew up, in Kakuma refugee camp, which is northwest of Kenya, in a very semi-arid environment. And so initially really hot temperatures, there were no shelters when we started there, but incrementally the camp grew and infrastructure grew. So I started my classrooms basically in open ground, writing in dirt, and subsequently having proper classrooms with walls and roof over us, and some exercise books. And so it were from those beginnings that I witnessed a lot to do with the human conditions, access to healthcare, the nature of health system itself when it is lacked, and now where we have well-functioning health system. So I'm able to compare and contrast from those beginnings to now.
That's amazing. Were you with your family in those camps?
Yeah, so I subsequently resettled in Australia with mum, as well as siblings, and they're all in Melbourne, older sister, two younger brothers. And we were all on the same program. So the humanitarian visa that brought us to Australia was for family. And so initially came to Melbourne in July of 2005. I had at that time been at year 10 level, which is Form 2 in Kenya.
So how old was that? You're about 14, 15?
No, I was about 17.
17,
so,
okay. Yes.
So I arrived in Kenya. People don't necessarily start schooling when they are supposed to, as they do in Australia. Okay. Yep. So when I moved into refugee camp, we were able to just access whatever was provided. And so the various international agencies which were based there, such as Lutheran World Federation and another one, DWS, which is also German, catered for education, while UNHCR provided other services such as food distribution, water and healthcare was provided by International Committee for Red Crosses, which would include Australian Red Cross as well. So they catered for healthcare. So various agencies provided various things to the refugees. And so when education started, I started when it became available rather than because I was old enough, because some people who were a decade older than me were in my class in primary school. And so when I arrived, I was 17, and I had been to Form 2 level. because in Kenya, the other hurdle is that high school was not free. So while there was this semblance of free education within the camp provided by the international agencies, we were within the Kenyan education system. And we had to compete with meager resources in the camp, no library, not enough lighting overnight, and having to study for national exams and compete with everyone else in Kenya who had better resources for sports at high school. And so I was fortunate enough to do very well at the end of year eight, where everyone sits national exam to then exit primary school into high school and perform in the top four. And so I was able to secure a scholarship from JSU Refugee Service. And that's how I first left the camp for a boarding school in Kenya, which is now a national school. And so I went to a boarding school starting at year nine level, which is Form 1 equivalent in Kenya. There are four years of high school in Kenya. And I was intent on doing those while living in boarding school under this scholarship. But because the resettlement program kicked in and we got accepted on humanitarian visa to Australia as a family, then I resettled when I was two-thirds of the way through year 10. And had I actually went to year 12 level in Kenya and exited with good grades as well, then I might have ended up in Canada, because this is where this scholarship program took the high school graduates.
Well, we're very lucky to have you.
Yeah, and I'm very lucky too to be here, because the rest of family was able to come with me on the same journey, unlike if I had resettled in Canada and then having to work on bringing them on another trip. In addition, I have been able to come at the appropriate time, such as to enter high school at appropriate level, complete VCE, so year 11 and 12, and so my grades could count for applying to university, and also fortunate to have been at university, to be in Melbourne, because there are great universities there as well, and medical schools, because at that point, I was only 2 years in Australia, and I was still familiarizing myself with my my environs, not aware of where things are in Melbourne, let alone actually applying to university and studying medicine. So it was a very sharp learning curve, but I was intent on studying medicine at that point.
Tell me, were there any other countries, you mentioned Canada, in the mix? You've ended up in Australia, so how was it that you made the journey to Australia?
So the initial resettlement program started with USA during Bush administration. Various church groups noted the plight of people from South Sudan, at the time Southern Sudan. The country has been at war for two decades. And the events of September 11 spotlighted Sudan and the crisis in there, particularly because Osama bin Laden happened to have been hiding out there for a decade and planning various attacks, both across Eastern Africa, such as in Nairobi and in Tanzania, as well as in US. And so this brought Sudan conflict to the attention of the US government. And then various church groups have also been advocating in context that a lot of people in Southern Sudan who are Christian were being persecuted, because at that point, the war had started at a point when the president of the Sudan at the time imposed Sharia law across the whole country. And so there was this mix of global politics into it, and years of people who have been in displaced camps, refugee camp, and ambivalent, not able to go back to where they were born and not able to seek asylum elsewhere where they can get services. And a lot of people were in limbo. And so USA at the time started a resettlement program initially targeted at a group that they call unaccompanied minors, because as you can imagine, in the setting of the Sudan at the time, there weren't a lot of telecommunication facilities. And so when war breaks out and people get attacked in whatever locations, they dispersed and they escaped wherever they feel safe. And so they don't necessarily notify the other family members about where they are and where they are headed, and could be several months or even years before they are known whether they're alive or not, until word of mouth gets around or Red Cross is able to facilitate handwritten letters to be exchanged between various displaced camps or refugee camps. And this is how people track themselves. But that meant there were a lot of people who were unaccompanied minors, people who didn't have either mom or dad, and they're young, they're under 18. And there were many of those in refugee camp that I was in. So this was the initial target group for resettlement by the U.S. government. And so that program initiated a process where people who can come and profile stories and facilitate the resettlement process, do the application, were able to come to the refugee camp. Because in as much as people had needs and wanted to resettle and could probably gain more opportunities when they resettle, there was no mechanism at that point for people to actually resettle. The refugee camp was at least hundreds of kilometers away from Nairobi, the capital, which is where the Australian High Commission is based. And so there were no mechanisms for people to even apply to come to Australia. There was no access to humanitarian visa program where people can apply, even if they were legally registered as refugees in Kenya.
So, Garang, tell me, you arrive in Australia and you have your first experience in a Melbourne classroom. What was that like, walking into the school in Australia and trying to make friends with new classmates and try to understand what they were teaching you?
Yeah, so it was a sharp curve, as I mentioned briefly before, in various ways. First of all, I arrived and all my referees were now left in Kenya. So all the teachers who ever taught me were all in Kenya.
Yes.
And there was no one that could sort of vouch for me, especially when
Back you up.
So having just arrived from a refugee setting and with ambitions to then subsequently go and study medicine, which I quickly understood was a very a competitive process, then it became apparent that a lot of my teachers initially didn't believe that I was going to be up to the task, because part of the challenge was that a lot of my teachers had been exposed to individuals who are of South Sudanese or Sudanese background, but who had come ahead of me. However, they had had some challenges with education system here, mostly because their previous education was based on in Arabic pattern. So they have not been in English class before because they happen to have lived in Egypt or another Arabic-speaking country. So it was an anomaly to most of them to then start seeing people coming from Kenya and were relatively competitive or competent in English. And so that was one of the challenges that I had to confront at the point of admission, because at that point, I suspect it is still the case now, there are English language programs that people tended to be channeled into. So those who have arrived in Australia and didn't have good grasp of English language and who might therefore have difficulty taking on some of the classes that they're signing up for would initially be taken to the English language school for this crash course or program in English. And that was sort of an automatic channel that a lot of people of South Sudanese background or Sudanese background were channeled into, except when I then had a conversation with the admission team in high school, and they realized that I was going to be fine. So that was first hurdle. And then the second one was now selecting the courses that I needed to do as prerequisites to then apply to the courses I was interested in university.
I hope someone helped you with that.
Yeah, so there were career advisors in high school, and I had a brief discussion with them, but that first first expectation that I might not be able to do well in them, because I had just recently resettled in Australia, was another barrier that I had to overcome. And so having signed up in classes that were mostly sciences, doing chemistry, yes, physics, yep, biology,
physics,
math. Yes. in Victoria, we have a specialist math as well as mathematical method. And so I was able, mm-hmm, to do those. And fortunately, I did very well in them. It was also fortunate at that point that I had other friends who were older than me that I had known back in Kenya. And these friends happened to be in a university program, which was for people who are undertaking high school curriculum. So they're sitting for their VCE, but through, yes, Victoria University in Melbourne, because they were much older than the students that were allowed for high school age. And so this was fortunate because it meant they actually had Victoria University ID, the identity card that they can use, yes, to borrow, okay, books from, yep, library. Yep. And having resettled in part of Melbourne, which didn't have a lot of resources in its public library, I was then able to use this opportunity to be able to borrow books from university and use them for my classes. And this is how I caught up with some of the classes while I didn't have access to a lot of resources.
What an incredible story.
Yeah. So this was a mix of various things. And so initially, I did a lot of interaction with my fellow students in basketball court, playing basketball, and made friends through those channels.
Yes.
And even more when I start doing well in classes, then a lot of my classmates start joining my group as well to then work together on math and related subjects.
And so you finished your year 12 exams and you got the good news, obviously, that you did very well. You must have done extremely well to get into medicine. What happened then?
So in medical school, I was eventually in at University of Melbourne. And the good part of it was I was in a convenient location, so living at Ormond College at University of Melbourne. Ormond had initially come to my attention through Kwang Lee Dao Young Scholars Program, which I had been nominated for during high school years. So this was, okay, a program that was targeted at high achievers with intent to attract them to University of Melbourne. And as I understood it, about 1,200 or 12,000, I can't remember properly, had to be nominated across various high schools across the state and neighboring areas of New South Wales as well as South Australia. And within that applicant pool, I was able to be subsequently awarded Kwang Lee Dao Young Scholars Award. And this exposed the scholars early on in their high school journey to university learning and resources of University of Melbourne. I was not able to harness them very well because it required that one has reliable internet as well as computers to be able to, yes, access the online programs and resources. And I didn't have some of those, definitely not reliable internet. I was able to get initially a computer as a scholarship award for doing very well in math and sciences in high school through Western Chances. But I couldn't keep up with reliable internet thereafter, having been only a year and a half in Australia. So there was this weekend where we were supposed to come together as scholars to Ormond College and be inducted into the program and spend time there. I wasn't familiar with Melbourne at that point. I didn't know my way around it. And there was no one who could take me to the location. None in my social network had been to University of Melbourne. And so I was aware of Ormond through that context. But subsequently, living at Ormond had been really very good because it's a convenient location, very diverse student population, studying various things and coming from different parts of the world, not only Australia. And so dinner time discussions were often very rich and full of insights from various academic background as well as cultural background and experiences, and definitely enjoyed my time engaging in CIMO readership program, which was around philosophy, discussing various things about the nature and the contours of justice and what is the right thing to do, and piqued my interest in policy actually at that point. But that convenient location also allowed me to partake in various programs and initiatives. So while studying medicine at University of Melbourne and attending clinical schools within Melbourne Health, so Royal Melbourne, Royal Women as well as Royal Children, I was also able to become research assistant to Professor Hugh Taylor, who has done immense work in Indigenous eye care. And that opened my eyes to a lot of things about doing policy research. So a lot of evidence sits around sometimes without being able to impact policy, but being able to then drive policy from a research perspective, generating evidence and crafting that evidence in a way that matters for the decision maker and scoping out impact. So I was able to be involved across the full spectrum of that and gain critical insights into how one might change various things in health system. And that definitely pushed me towards exploring opportunities for building a skill set in that area. And that's what moved me towards exploring training in health policy subsequently.
Okay. And is that how the John Monash Foundation Scholarship came about?
Yes, correct. So when I started in medical school, I did not know about John Monash Scholarship. A lot of my information was limited by lack of the relevant network that was exposed to these things. I didn't know where University of Melbourne was and the programs that were there until very late. I was able to learn about all these scholarships much later. And so it was an incremental process. Subsequent reading exposed me to various things that were happening at Harvard University, definitely after reading Atul Gawande on various things that is written about, including checklist and how to improve system performance in surgery in his book, such as Better. And while at Ormond College, I was able to win what was then called John Manson Fellowship, which took me to New Delhi. And at that point, the other option was going to Johns Hopkins to do a placement in neurosurgery. But I was keen on looking at how settings like India, which are relatively under-resourced and with a lot of challenges in their health system, are able to still deliver high-quality services in healthcare and how they innovate. And so this fellowship gave me an opportunity to visit St. Stephen's Hospital in Tisazari, which happened to be one of pilot centers for Atul Gawande's checklist. And I then realized some of the challenges it's written about in the book are actually still around. But at the same time, I was able to see how the hospital innovates to be able to deliver high quality service to a relatively poor population, both within its immediate catchment area as well as some slum areas of New Delhi. And so I was able to head out on a van and explore the ways that health service was being delivered in this community through mobile clinics and also highly technical things such as surgical intervention in settings where you might not have reliable electricity coming off the main grid. So I was able to see that sort of diversity of challenges that impacts on quality, even when you have highly skilled surgeons, for example, what else is needed around them to be able to deliver the quality service that they could. And so I was able to use that opportunity as a learning point. And at that point, also reached out to Atul Gawande about what I was experiencing there and things he's written in his book, and also explore the opportunities that could allow me to be more effective are driving policy or health systems reforms. And so coming back to Melbourne at that point, I continued through medical school and completed my studies, but also continued to work closely with Professor Hugh Taylor. And that's when I started exploring as well the opportunities that could allow me to go and study in the same settings where all these things were being done by individuals like Atul Gawande. And that's how Harvard University came onto my radar, because as you can imagine, when I resettled in Australia, I had never heard of Harvard University. I had definitely heard of Oxford University because of its...
Well, you've now studied at both.
I've studied at both, yes, fortunately. But I heard of Oxford because of its English dictionary. This is how I heard about it in the camp, because I did not have access to internet at that point. So this is why a lot of things were not on my radar until when I found the opportunity to be online and explored, and also my social network grew as a result of being at Ormond College and University of Melbourne and living longer in Australia.
Gurang, I'm just blown away by you and your career. It's just phenomenal. So you've studied at two of the best universities on the planet, and you're joining us today from Canberra, where you are now living and working in the Australian national capital. Tell us about the work you were doing at the moment in Canberra.
So at the moment, I'm working within ANU to drive various initiatives focused on strengthening the health system. But at the same time, I am within Australian Department of Health as part of a team that provides a lot of technical support to the policies related to the pandemic. And within that context, I've also looked at various turns of things as the pandemic went on, which includes how some of the most disadvantaged households are not necessarily having same experience as everyone else. And so I have taken additional initiative to come and lead a campaign for improving uptake of vaccines in low-income households. People that I know have had past refugee experience or the recent migrants and have various challenges accessing the health system as it is, including the general practice-based immunization strategy, as well as the pop-up clinics, which are trying to make immunization convenient. I've realized that a major part of the challenge is not necessarily just the convenience. It's about the trust in vaccines. And that is kind of compounded by what has built up over time and has become known as a trust deficit in government or authorities. Yes. And so just having official communication through television, such as SBS, the approach is to translate them so they are available in a language that might be accessible, but the platform is not necessarily optimal. And so when Canberra went into lockdown, what we realized within this community is that at least 40% of the cases came from low-income households of people, say people of my cultural background, for instance. And so I took initiative and worked closely with the community leadership here, as well as ACT Health, to be able to manage the outbreak, make sure there's compliance with quarantine, as well as people are sensitized towards getting vaccines. And this went very well because we flipped the management process of the pandemic to be more community-led rather than government-led. We get the community to initiate the detailing of the strategy and co-design what might work with the support of the government and various agencies, rather than what is often done top-down, where you devise what would be the best policy and then implement it. Mm-hmm. It became more a co-design process. And this was really instrumental because we have a situation where the pandemic is not so much about the medical knowledge per se. When you're talking about contact tracing, it's about the knowledge of social networks. And there are no people in government who know social networks in the community better than the community leaders. The people who lead those households know their social networks very well. So it was about tapping into those channels of authorities to harness their insights for optimal response. And then some of the initiatives we took as well is filming short video with ACT Health involving community leaders as well, so that we can target the message more correctly and distribute it in the channels that people tend to access, which tends to be social media groups, both on WhatsApp and Facebook. Also did focus discussions over Zoom, which targeted church groups, say congregations, which are more appropriate for targeting older population within this community. So these are some of the initiatives I've been working on as well. And this worked really well with the first community-led clinic that we did in Canberra, and that successfully immunized 100% of those who were registered. And we are now repeating the process so that we immunize as many as possible. And from here, we took the insights from this success, and we now are scaling it nationally. So I'm working with health services and state governments in the other states, definitely in a setting like Melbourne, which has a large population of recent migrants. And so scaling this in a regionalized context because of the larger population group and decentralized health system there. So say Monash Health and Western Health, and the same for South Australia, we're targeting health services catchment areas that are most relevant. And this is fortunately working well in some settings where there's been more reception for it. And resourcing of the relevant team that we put together.
And finally, Garang, as a medical professional, are you able to offer an opinion on how Australia is now faring with respect to vaccine rollout and trying to get on top of the pandemic, the coronavirus?
I think so far there's been confluence of factors, some which can be concretely judge from a medical perspective and some which would not be. I tend to think that the best thing in the end is more of everyone continuing to cooperate so that we all get as much immunization coverage as possible, because as it is, the current vaccines reduce the hospitalization and rate of death within the community, and that's what needs to be done. The pandemic itself is not being stamped out completely because it's gone global, and there are likelihood of new variants. So from the hindsight, it can be relatively easy for us to say we could have done this better, and that is something that should be taken on board for the future, which is part of why my team within Department of Health is involved in documenting some of this. So doing publications around the pandemic, which has not happened a lot in the past. And this is a way for Australia to capture insights from this pandemic so that we can improve health system going forward and be more responsive. But from the initial stage, there were a lot of uncertainty, a lot of missing pieces of information about what needs to be done. And that vantage point had a lot of challenges which may not be appreciated very well in retrospective conversation. And so I would like to think that from the way Australians have been complying with the pandemic lockdown for a long part, notwithstanding some incidences of protest, I think we're doing relatively well in terms of people taking leadership on their own individual level to realize that they have a part to play in it, regardless of the resourcing the government has put behind it, regardless of the political decisions and whether they're correct or not. It comes down to what every other Australian is doing.
Well, Dr. Garang Dutt, it's been an honor to talk to you today on the podcast. You're an inspiration, and you are just a wonderful human being, and we're very lucky as a country to have you with us. So thank you for joining us, and keep up the good work. We will look forward to following your career with much interest in the years ahead. Thank you so much for joining us on the Scholars Podcast.
Thank you for having me.